A lot of basic biology we take for granted. We eat, we sleep, you can complete the list, but some of us have difficulties with some of that basic biology, including the sleep part. Insomnia plagues some of the population, limiting sleep in duration or quality or both. Today's guest is not a naturally good sleeper. Lois Maharg began a blog a while back called The Savvy Insomniac. She has now extended and expanded that effort into a book also called The Savvy Insomniac. Lois researches and writes about sleep, exercise, and food. Obviously, we'll talk about sleep in this hour. Lois, thanks for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Well, thanks for having me, Jeffrey. I'm really happy to be here.
You call yourself a bona fide insomniac. Give us the history here. How far back does it go?
Well, according to my mother, I was a shaky sleeper even as an infant. And it wasn't that I didn't sleep, but it was that I was easily awakened by noises that most babies would sleep through, such as just a little bit louder conversation or a dog barking two houses down or something like that. I'd wake up and cry. But the first inkling that I had that I was in any way different from other people was when I was in four-year kindergarten. And I went to a half-day kindergarten when I was 4 years old, and every morning at 10 a.m., we'd have to drag out the mats to supposedly take a nap. Well, what I realized when I listened to my classmates was that they were all having that sort of slow, sonorous, rhythmic breathing that you associate with sleep, and I was nowhere near sleeping. I couldn't sleep to save my soul, it seemed. So I think I've been a light sleeper and a short sleeper really all my life.
It sounds like you've gotten some really interesting responses over the years from admitting that you are an insomniac. So do you avoid admitting it, or have you over the years?
Oh, yes. I mean, for many years, in fact, for most of the years of my life, I felt that it was sort of, you know, stigmatized. And actually, I've just written a blog about that, which I'm going to post on Monday. But I think that, you know, in the past, people made certain assumptions about you, like you had a lot of psychological problems, or maybe you were drinking too much coffee, or you were a complainer, you were a hypochondriac, or something like that. So basically, I didn't mention it really to almost anyone.
And it sounds like when you did, people were often quick with the remedies. People want to be helpful and all that sort of thing.
Oh, sure, sure. It was like drink warm milk at bedtime, or drink a glass of wine at bedtime, or get a new mattress, or, you know, a whole host of things that didn't seem to be very effective. Oh, and, of course, I tried them all. Toward middle age, I just decided, you know, none of this is working, and I wasn't really getting much help from my doctors either, which were basically primary care physicians. And so I decided to go myself in search of answers.
Well, and some of the remedies that people outside the medical community had recommended, as you point out with a good turn of a phrase, it was like recommending a baby aspirin for a migraine.
Yes, yes. I experimented with mattresses, but, that had nothing to do with my internal biology. The idea that you need to give up caffeine, well, I think most people in the sleep community now are realizing that we've gone a little bit too far with that. Caffeine is a drug, like many other substances, but it has a half-life and the body metabolizes it. And so the idea that you have to give up caffeine completely is not sort of in accordance with what they're showing in the studies these days. Caffeine early in the day may not be a problem at all.
So, Lois, through your life, how much sleep has had to suffice? And is it less a function of quantity than quality?
Oh, well, I think that a lot of times people are sort of focused on the number of hours that they need to sleep. And when I look back at myself, I think it might have started early on when my parents insisted that I go to bed at 10:30 when I was a 10-year-old, which is a completely normal time for people to go to bed, right, when they're 10 years old.
Mm-hmm.
But I would lie in bed and think through my day or read or whatever. I mean, it was really too early for me to be going to bed. So I knew pretty early on that I was what they call a short sleeper. In other words, I didn't need 7 to 8 hours sleep. I needed more in the vicinity of 6 or even maybe 5.5, something like that might suffice. So, but what I came to find out, what I really discovered, and this is in part because of all the reading and the talking to the experts and attending conferences, but also, in my own search for better sleep, what I realized was that it's the sleep quality that really matters. If you can have good, deep, sound, restorative sleep, then that's what matters much more than how long you're actually sleeping.
Is it the REM sleep? Is it the dream phase? Is it all the above?
Well, it's really all of the above, but in fact, you know, there are two types of sleep, one being REM sleep, which is dream sleep, which, it's associated with the highest percentage of dreaming, let's put it that way. And that usually comes, a lot of it comes toward the end of the night. But at the beginning of the night, what we have is called non-REM or quiet sleep. And there are three different stages of quiet sleep, and the third stage is the deepest stage of sleep, and that's really the restorative stuff. That's, you know, when growth hormone is secreted and the repair of tissue takes place and all that. And you need to be getting, you know, enough of that.
All right, we'll have much more to talk about with Lois Maharg about her book, The Savvy Insomniac, A Personal Journey Through Science to a Better Sleep. We'll find out what some of the remedies were that did finally work for Lois and what she's heard from lots of other people around the world with her condition. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange when we come back to talk more with Lois about The Savvy Insomniac here on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Lois Maharg, a health journalist who writes about matters involving sleep and food and much more. She's written a lot about sleep in her blog, The Savvy Insomniac, now in a book form also called The Savvy Insomniac, A Personal Journey Through Science to Better Sleep. Join us on the exchange with your stories of problems sleeping or remedies that might have worked over the years or questions for Lois at 800-838-3760 anywhere in our listening area. Our local number for Jackson and Josephine counties, the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. Lois, you talk early in the book about functioning versus surviving. Over the years, which has felt like the dominant one with the lack of sleep you've had?
Well, it's been functioning, you know, striving to function, to feel, you know, like my mood is good and that I'm not too fatigued and that my thinking is, you know, I'm able to concentrate and think creatively and so forth. I think the daytime symptoms of insomnia are something that sort of people don't think about. At least people who don't have problems sleeping don't typically associate with insomnia. But in fact, those are every bit as troublesome as the daytime or the nighttime symptoms.
Like what?
Well, for instance, people who have insomnia typically report feeling very tired and exhausted during the day. One of the people I interviewed for my book had a very good way of describing it, I thought. She said, you know, it's like you're always pushing a boulder uphill. And that's what it feels like sometimes. And, you know, a lot of people have to struggle with that at work, but other people find that it limits what we can do in our free time. You know, we just don't feel like going to a concert or going out and riding our bikes. Another thing people struggle with is a low mood. As it turns out, insomnia and depression are very strongly linked. And, you know, many times people feel depressed. Some people also have trouble controlling their temper. Many people have told me that that's their number one concern, that they're screaming all the time at their coworkers or screaming at their, you know, their kids or something. And finally, it does interfere with thinking and with learning and with memory stabilization. So it's the daytime symptoms, I think, are my, you know, every bit as bad as the symptoms we have at night.
So it's not like science has missed insomnia. It certainly happens to enough people. And do we know approximately how many, for example, in the United States?
Yes. The numbers vary, but a conservative estimate is about 10% of the population has trouble with some kind of persistent insomnia. And maybe 30-35% struggle sometimes with sleep. So persistent insomnia is really, the type of insomnia that you need to be concerned about, because it is associated with all kinds of health risks. Hypertension, heart disease, obesity, diabetes. I did mention depression, but also anxiety. And it's even associated with greater risk for suicide. So it's not something you want to play around with.
So is the association causal in one direction or the other?
Well, actually, they haven't established causality now. It's a correlation, basically, that people talk now in terms of risk factors. It puts you at higher risk for hypertension. Persistent insomnia puts you at higher risk for heart disease. But this past year, they're rethinking that whole thing about causality and which direction causality moves in when we're thinking about insomnia and depression. And what they've discovered is that many times insomnia can be a causal factor in depression. In fact, you're twice as likely to develop depression down the road if you have persistent insomnia.
So obviously a lot of research into the health conditions that tend to show up with insomnia.
And, right.
But how much research into insomnia itself? And and how far back in history have we been researching insomnia?
Well, people have been talking about insomnia, using that word, since about the middle of the 19th century, or the last third of the 19th century. There was a, as far as I could tell in my historical research, the first person to really spread that word to talk about sleeplessness or vigilance or watchfulness, which are the terms that were used before, was a neurologist named William Hammond. But back then, the causes were very speculative, and he came up with this idea based on some research, into people's heads that insomnia occurred when blood flow was too great and that the blood vessels became flabby. It's sort of like, a rubber band can lose its elastic. Well, that was his theory. Well, of course, it didn't really hold water, and so that was dismissed. But people have been, researching insomnia really seriously, I would say, since about the 1960s, with many more tools than they used to have. And during the 20th century, the predominant theory of causality there was that it was, that it was a psychological problem. It was very much linked to people who had, depression, anxiety, and other kinds of psychological disorders. But in the 60s and 70s was when they started looking, testing, functioning, testing biological functions of people with insomnia, and finding that we do have some differences from people who sleep normally.
What kinds of differences? And I love the use of the term psychophys. I know you didn't create it, but
should
start
right.
with the phys first, as you point out, physiological first.
Right. Well, actually, to say a bit about that, and then I'll come back to your question here. Psychophysiological insomnia, I always thought, meant that, it was driven by primarily psychological factors. But I was set straight by a sleep expert I interviewed for my book, Michael Perlis. He said, no, psychophysiological insomnia is really primarily driven by biological factors, but because biopsychological didn't seem to be pronounced easily, they decided to call it psychophysiological. Anyway, but to get back to your question, early on what they found was that the insomnia sufferers tended to have a slightly higher heart rate than normal sleepers, lower heart rate variability, which is another measure of arousal. It correlates with higher amount of arousal. They found that, during the day, our body temperature fluctuates, and they found that, especially in people who are older with insomnia, the typical going down of the temperature that normally occurs at night doesn't go down as far in older insomnia sufferers, and also that we consume higher volume of oxygen, which probably relates to metabolism, whole body metabolism. So there are some differences in bodily functions, but there are also some differences in our brains.
But the biological differences, first off, the non-brain stuff, it sounds like essentially this is a machine that doesn't wind down quite like so many of the other ones do.
That's so true, yes. And they have sort of, they've coined a term for it. And the sort of the predominant theory of causality as far as heart insomnia goes is now the hyperarousal theory. And the idea is just that our bodies are cranked up a notch too high. The balance of arousing forces and quieting forces isn't quite adjusted right.
Lois Maharg is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a health journalist writing about food and sleep and other topics, and we're talking definitely about sleep today. Her blog and her book are called The Savvy Insomniac, the book subtitled A Personal Journey Through Science to Better Sleep. Lois, as you've heard, deals with insomnia herself. You can join us here on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about the subject matter and the potential remedies for it. 800-838-3760, anywhere you can hear us. Our Rogue Valley local number, 541-552-6782. And the email address, jx@jeffnet.org. So we talked about the body differences. There are brain differences, too, for insomniacs, you say.
That's right. And you know, in the past, what they noticed was when people would come in for sleep studies, which was, you know, common for people with struggling with insomnia, what they observed was about 50% of the time, people who claimed to be sleeping just a few hours a night were actually registering on the, you know, the electroencephalogram as sleeping a normal number of hours, 7 or 8 hours. So what was going on there? Well, it turns out that they've discovered when they've done special studies of brain waves of insomniacs at night that there are parts of our brain that are actually active at night, and that there are very fast waveforms occurring in certain parts of our brains, which indicate that part of the brain is actually possibly processing information even while we sleep. So that might explain, for example, why certain people like me are very susceptible to being awakened when there are noises at night, because we're processing, we're taking in information from the environment even as we sleep. There are other neuroimaging studies that they've conducted to find out where are these hotspots in insomniacs' brains. And at first, they were looking at the cortex, which is the, you know, the outer layer of the brain. But now they've located some areas in the limbic area of the brain, the more inner sort of midsection of the brain that are more connected to emotion and you know, processing feelings of the self, introspection, and that sort of thing. So, you know, it might be that insomnia is, you might be able to say about it that it's really a hybrid state.
Well, and I should point out, the book is not about your own experience by a long shot. You've interviewed lots of other people who are dealing with insomnia and lots of people who are attempting to find answers to what causes it. And it often seems to come back for a lot of the people you talk to who are dealing with insomnia to my mind would not quit.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, I think 9 out of 10 people, that is their main complaint, that the mind just keeps going and going. And they have found that in general, when they've done studies comparing insomnia sufferers to normal sleepers, what they find is that it takes about twice as long for those insomniacs to descend into the deepest levels of sleep as it does normal sleepers. So, yeah, the mind just keeps going and going.
Lois Maharg, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, her book, The Savvy Insomniac, also the name of her blog. Here's TJ in Murphy. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. I'm calling because, well, I used to sleep so well. I never thought insomnia would apply to me. But when I became a mother, I started not sleeping as well, which makes some sense to me in terms of, you know, biologically making sure your child survives and being tuned into what they might need during the night. But it's exhausting. And I wonder if you found in your research a correlation there and maybe a time when that potentially goes away. I'd love to hear about that, and I'll take the answer off the air.
All right. Thanks for the call, TJ. Appreciate it. And yes, there is a fair amount of the book about motherhood and insomnia.
Yes, I mean, that is a time when people who are going to be vulnerable to insomnia are going to probably experience it because, as you say, people are, you know, attuned to other people in their lives now. And so the pattern gets set up where they're always being vigilant. And then once you get through that period, once your children are a little bit older and they start sleeping through the night, you're left with that sleep problem. And so there are a lot of things that you can do to sort of reestablish good sleep. And one would be to be very regular. You've probably heard this before, but I will reiterate that. A lot of times what they found is that once people develop insomnia, it continues because of certain habits we develop in order to, we think, that's going to help us get better sleep, but in fact it works against us. And one of those things is could be going to bed too early before we're really ready to sleep. But another thing is varying the time when we get up. It turns out that people who are vulnerable to insomnia are in some ways less flexible about sleep timing than people who are normal sleepers. And getting up at the same time every day is going to help your sleep drive every day build up to the point where it needs to in order to fall asleep easily and stay asleep the next night. So a firm get-up time is a good thing. Another thing that they counsel people with insomnia to avoid is taking naps. Again, what will happen is if you take a nap that's longer than, say, about 30 minutes, you're likely to descend into deep sleep. And, you know, it's like sort of eating an appetizer before dinner. It's going to take a slice out of your appetite. Well, the nap is going to take a slice out of the sleep time at night. So those are a couple of things to do to try to restore your sleep to what it was before.
When you consider the biological mechanisms involved in insomnia that you display in the book here, particularly when you talk about our survival attributes as human beings in a world full of predators, we generally sound pretty lame. It's a wonder we ever slept, I think.
That's so true. Yes. And I think, you know, of course, it wasn't sleep. You know, some people have asked, some sleep experts asked, well, why would humans sleep at all, right? Because we were in such peril at night. Well, it turns out sleep is good for many things. You know, it allows the body to sort of cool down after a long spate of metabolizing energy and stuff. But and it allows, you know, certain immune functions to be restored, and it helps with memory. It helps probably helped our brains grow larger and that sort of thing. But as it turns out, there is kind of a built-in survival mechanism in our sleep, and that's something I think most of us are not aware of, or at least good sleepers might not be aware of, and that is that we actually go through several sleep cycles during the night, maybe four or five, and so we're waking up maybe three or four times a night, even though we're not aware of that. And so that would have been very protective in terms of being able to, you know, be alert and ready at a moment's notice to escape from whatever harm was coming your way.
Right, and given bodies that do not have sharp claws or the ability to run fast or climb trees or you know, spring to great heights.
Exactly. We needed some built-in insurance during the night.
So that's the biological underpinning, but then a lot gets blamed, and you bring this up in the book as well. I mean, the development of the electric light, but I mean, we had candles and lanterns and all sorts of other things to light our way through the dark for eons before Thomas Edison got onto the final solution.
Right. Those things didn't burn very brightly, and it's really bright light, particularly bright light with blue light in it, that will affect your body's your rhythm of your body body clock cycle. So that, you know, basically, before the advent of the electric light bulb, we were basically going to sleep at, you know, sundown and getting up, you know, at sunrise and that sort of thing. But now we have electrical lighting and you know, lights from computer screens and tablets and smartphones and everything 24/7 if we have them. And so that can shift your cycle to be out of sync with the cycle of daylight and darkness on the earth, and that's definitely something you'd want to avoid.
All right, so we got electric lights, we got clocks, but, you know, when you go back in time with us in the book, we get back to some of the great answers that medical science once had for things like people who couldn't sleep. And what was the one thing? Was it taking warm sheep lungs?
Warm sheep's lungs and putting them on the forehead was supposed to be one good remedy. And another one was taking horse leeches and putting them behind the ears, and once they'd burrowed a hole, putting a little grain of opium on top.
Wow, that's inventive.
Well, it would have scared me right out of sleeping the whole night.
Right, I wouldn't have gotten near it. Anyway, The Savvy Insomniac is the book and the blog. Lois Maharg, the creator of both, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We'll come back and talk more with her about insomnia and potential remedies for it when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Hey, it's the final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is health journalist Lois Maharg, who writes about sleep and food and much more. Today we're going to focus on sleep. Her blog and her book both bear the name The Savvy Insomniac. The book just out includes the subtitle A Personal Journey Through Science to Better Sleep. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about insomnia and sleep and how to get from one to the other. Our phone number is here, 800-838-3760, anywhere you can hear us. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. Lois, you point out that insomnia and sleep deprivation are not the same thing. So how do we pull those apart?
That's right. We often think that insomnia equates to sleep deprivation, but in fact, when people who are studying sleep and insomnia are using those terms, they're different. And sleep deprivation is when you are taking either partial deprivation or full deprivation, where you are depriving someone of sleep for an entire night, or maybe you're giving them just 4 hours to sleep at night. And so over time, that person becomes sleep deprived. But with insomnia, with people with insomnia, we are people who can't sleep as much as we'd like to, or can't achieve the kind of quality sleep we'd like to, even when we're given the opportunity. So some people speculate that it may actually, driving insomnia may not be so much sleep deprivation as something else, and that's that hyperarousal that we talked about earlier.
Just a general awareness of things around you and an inability to disconnect from that?
Basically that, yes. Uh-huh. And also something I didn't mention before was that we tend to have higher levels of alerting hormones in our circulating in our bodies, and so that, again, would support that hyperarousal theory of insomnia.
Do those include cortisol? Because you pointed out something I was not aware of, and we've done some other books and discussions of sleep, but the fact that cortisol production rises as you get closer to waking up
mm-hmm.
after night's sleep.
That's right. But actually, we're talking about sort of throughout the day, that mm-hmm. Not all studies show this, but enough do that I think the general consensus is that probably we're dealing with more cortisol in the bloodstream, as do people with a depression. That's one way in which those two disorders are similar.
Well, and you'd mentioned already about the low mood and depression being connected to insomnia, in which mm-hmm. direction we're still not quite clear. But there's a quote in here from Rosalind Cartwright about how sleep helps the downregulation of negative emotion, which is an interesting way to phrase it, but it makes sense when you think about it, because the things that trouble you before a good night's sleep generally don't trouble you as much, or at least you have a new perspective after a good night's sleep.
Well, that's exactly what happens, and this happens mostly during REM sleep, which comes, the majority of it comes at the end of the night. So if you have several short nights, you're probably going to be in a bad mood. What sleep does for us when we're getting enough is it basically doesn't help us forget whatever negative incident it was, but it somehow extracts the negative tone from that episode. So it's not so troublesome to us then after a good night's sleep.
So for you and the people you interviewed, I mean, when you try to compare what your experience is with those of people who sleep well, I mean, did you ever have early in your life a good long run of good sleep that you could say, hey, this is what I know it's supposed to feel like?
Right. I actually did. I am one of those people, and one thing I discovered when I was doing my research is that insomnia takes many different forms. And so to treat it all the same is probably, you're probably going to miss the mark a lot. But my insomnia came in bouts where I would be going along for maybe a couple of weeks and I would think, oh, you know, I've finally graduated to becoming a normal sleeper. I'm finally growing up. And then some sort of stress would come along in my life, and stress seems to trigger my own bouts of insomnia, and it seems to be a trigger for many other people who suffer insomnia, you know, in a persistent way.
Chapter 4 of The Savvy Insomniac is looking for help, and you point out that you were 27 when you sought help. Is it fairly typical for insomniacs to wait well beyond childhood, well into adulthood?
It really is, yes. And I think in part it's because there's been this attitude, and it was certainly common in the 20th century, that sleep problems really are kind of trivial in comparison to other kinds of things, and that you should be able to regulate them yourself. And so a lot of people avoid going to the doctor in the early stages, and part of that can be, well, maybe they're afraid that all the doctor would do would be prescribe a sleeping pill, and some doctors will do that, of course. And so they don't realize that there's another remedy, or there are other remedies out there that might be as good or even better.
It seems like the remedies are probably as different as the doctors. You could probably get as many different suggestions for how to approach it as you would get different office visits.
It's possible that, but I think that a lot of primary care physicians are not aware of something called cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, which is really like the gold standard in treatment for people with insomnia. It is drug-free, and it's sort of a collection, at this point anyway, it's a collection of behavioral therapies and cognitive treatments to enable people to sleep better without drugs. And I think there are about 70% to 80% of the time people who try it derive some benefit. Some say they're completely cured. Others report just managing much better, and I can say the same. I would say that was very helpful to me.
Before we get to CBT, though, I want to address drugs a little further. Do a lot of insomniacs self-medicate? A lot of alcohol abuse, for example?
I think it's something like about 14% of people who suffer insomnia use alcohol to, self-medicate. Mm-hmm. And that's unfortunate, you know, because it does, in fact, help you get to sleep in the beginning, but it disturbs your sleep in the second part of the night, so that's not a good strategy. I think about that same percentage, I've forgotten the percentage exactly, but about that same percentage go to the drugstore and get the over-the-counter sleep aids like ZZ-Quil and Tylenol PM and Benadryl and that sort of thing. And these are not such great solutions either, particularly for older people with insomnia, because the half-life of those medications is pretty long once you get to be a certain age, and you can wake up with a lot of morning grogginess.
You point out, too, Lois, there's a big red state, blue state divide in the views of insomniacs toward medication generally.
That's right, and I think that's partly driven, and you know, by that I'm not referring to like to, you know, all Democrats take medication and all Republicans avoid it or vice versa.
Right.
That's not exactly what I was trying to suggest there, but more that I think that among people who have insomnia, persistent insomnia, there's a big divide between people who use medication and feel that it's necessary and appropriate, and those who avoid it like the plague. So of course some of us use it occasionally, but we might use it with reservations.
Well, then of course there are the natural remedies like melatonin, and I mean, any of these things uniformly effective?
melatonin happens to be very effective, or at least it is for many people who have trouble with the timing of their sleep. If you're a night owl, and if for some reason you're working in a situation where you have to work corporate hours, you know, if left to your own devices, you can't get to sleep until 3 a.m., that's going to be terrible if you have to get up at 7 in the morning. So melatonin is what they call a chronobiotic, in that it affects the timing of your sleep. And if you take it consistently at about dinner time, it can help you shift your sleep forward. So in essence, what you're doing is you're tricking your body into thinking that the night is coming earlier and you'll be ready for sleep at an earlier hour. Unfortunately, for a lot of people, what happens as we age is that we won't be producing enough melatonin in our bodies. And then people think, well, yeah, let's replenish that well, we're not producing ourselves with a supplement. But right now in the United States, the supplements that we buy over the counter are unregulated, and they're not time release. And the problem with these unregulated supplements is that they have a very short half-life. In other words, the body metabolizes them very quickly. And if you're the type who struggles to stay asleep at night, if you wake up several times during the night, a medication that's only going to affect you for about an hour after going to sleep is not really going to be of help to you. There is study of time-release melatonin, and that may be something that's coming in the future. And there's also a medication that's available in Europe and Israel and maybe some other countries of the world. It's called Circadin, and it is a time-release form of melatonin.
Oh, okay, so that would cover the time-release issue there then. Lois Maharg is our guest. Her book and blog, The Savvy Insomniac. We have an email from Jenny in Roseburg. She says, maybe you already covered this, but sleep for 8 hours has not been the whole history of human sleep and is not consistent across the world. I've read evidence that in European history it was typical to have 2 sleeps per 24 hours, and this is still true in parts of the world. Could it help some who cannot do a solid 8 hours of consistent sleep to try other historical and other cultural human sleep patterns? I've also read that some tribal people stagger sleep between individuals in the group so that somebody is always awake, suggesting that our variable sleep patterns may aid survival of the group. That, again, from Jenny and Roseburg.
Well, that last bit is certainly true. You know, it would speak to that whole need for survival at a time when we really didn't have much besides caves and trees, as far as rushing away from predators and that sort of thing. But yes, there have been studies, both historical studies and scientific studies, suggesting that it may have been before the advent of electric lighting that people divided their night in two. They took their first sleep, say, from about 8 or 9 in the evening till midnight or so, woke up, did house chores, went out to look at the fields, maybe, you know, fed the baby or what have you, and then maybe returned to bed an hour or two later and slept then until the sunrise at 8 o'clock or whatever, 7:30 in the morning. Other cultures, as the listener points out, have taken a mid-afternoon siesta and had very much success doing that. And again, this has to do with the fact that the reason that might work is because we are sleepiest when our body temperature is at a low point during the day, and there are two low points. One is about 2 hours before we wake up in the morning. That's sort of called the zombie zone, when everybody's dead tired. And then there's another circadian dip right in the middle of the afternoon, and that corresponds to the time when people were typically taking siestas. And, you know, for people who aren't able to sleep, a consolidated night's sleep, those are perfectly fine schedules to adopt. I spoke with a man who said that he got some of his best work done at night because he woke up with, just needing to be up, and so wrote his newsletter in 2 hours and then went back to sleep and finished sleeping, you know, in the morning. So we don't all need to have consolidated sleep. But what I hear from the sleep experts is this, that most people want that. So using various techniques to get that might be something that people choose to do.
And you pointed out that cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT, has proven helpful for a lot of people. What are some of the basic tenets of the approach?
Well, it's basically based on behavioral theories of insomnia, which starts with the idea that there are just some of us who are predisposed from birth to have this vulnerability to sleep problems. Then along comes some very stressful incident in our lives. Maybe we, you know, a divorce or lose your job or something like that, which would normally be a time when most people couldn't sleep very well. And then the third stage of that is that, okay, we realize we're not sleeping well, and so we start taking actions to sleep better. For example, this is something I mentioned earlier in the program, we start going to bed earlier to catch up on sleep, which seems personal, you know, perfectly a logical thing to do, or we start taking naps. Well, those are things that are going to perpetuate our problem rather than propelling us to better sleep. So with cognitive behavioral therapy, the first thing is to sort of get you on a very regular sleep schedule, which will help you regain confidence in your ability to actually fall asleep when you want to and stay sleeping through the night. Another thing is there's a cognitive component to CBT as well, where you're looking at some attitudes that you might have developed that interfere with good sleep. For example, the idea that you have to have 8 hours, mm-hmm. or the idea that you know, if I don't get a certain number of hours, I'm going to get sick.
So it's a lot of rethinking and reframing from the sounds
exactly,
of it.
Exactly,
okay.
Yes.
The Savvy Insomniac is the book and the blog. Lois Maharg, the creator, and our guest today on the Jefferson Exchange. Lois, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thanks so much. It's been a real pleasure.
Good to have you. Tomorrow on the Jefferson Exchange at 8 o'clock, we'll talk about a Smith River Road project halted for environmental reasons. Our Vents Day segment will deal with the University of Oregon handling of the alleged rape. And we'll talk about Wi-Fi in parks. Then we'll talk about the tech economy in Southern Oregon at 9, all tomorrow on the Exchange. Our producer is Charlotte Dern, our student assistant Reed Newland. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.